In his search for din, for Jewish law, for unity and authority, Rabban Gamliel of Yavne squelched debate. But free exchange is necessary for the achievement of emet, for truth. In this lecture, we will combine the approaches of lectures 1 and 2, but with an exciting twist. Our first lecture studied the larger structure of chapter 1 of Avot. Our second focused on one seminal individual in the chapter. Now, we will focus on how the structure of the first chapter tells us a great deal about the life of another significant individual, and how studying that individual's story helps us better understand the purpose and the structure of the chapter. But here is the twist. The person that we will be studying is not actually in this chapter or in Avot at all. We do not hear his words. His own maxim is not presented, but he speaks volumes by his absence. Indeed, once we understand the textual lacunae, we realize that the non-appearance of this rabbi is shocking. Indeed, one of the most surprising aspects of Avot. I call this the mystery of the missing Gamliel. Let us pick up from where we left off, from Hillel. Following the ascension of Hillel as Nasi and his service in the position with Shammai at his side, the period of the Zugot then comes to an end, and the patriarchate is linked forever with Hillel's house, with his descendants. The rest of the chapter is largely a description of these successors. But before we look at the text, we need first to know the names of who Hillel's successors were. The problem is that in Hillel's family, two names were extremely popular: Gamliel and Shimon. Once in a while, you would have a Yehuda as well, but by and large, it would be either Gamliel or Shimon. And if you had two children, then, as we will see in another lecture, you would name one Gamliel and the second one Shimon. If your name was Shimon, your son's name would be Gamliel. If your name was Gamliel, often your son's name would be Shimon. If you had two sons, Gamliel and then Shimon. Little known fact, if they had a third son in that family, Irving. Irving was the name. Okay. Now, in order to distinguish between all these individuals, all these Shimons and Gamliels, often other appellations or locations are added. Thus, the successor to Hillel was his grandson, Gamliel, who lived still during the Second Temple period. And he is known as Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, Rabban Gamliel the Elder. His son was Shimon, who was one of the Asara Harugei Malchut, killed by the Romans either during the destruction of the Temple or soon after. Meanwhile, fleeing the city, fleeing Jerusalem right before it was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, a student of Hillel but not his descendant, established an academy at Yavne. Rabbi Yochanan's students, especially Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, will be the focus of our future lectures. And after the destruction of the temple, Yavne represented the future of Rabbinic or Pharisaic Judaism. And the son of the murdered Shimon, whose name was Gamliel, made his way to Yavne and assumed the position of Nasi, with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai stepping aside at that point from leadership at the academy. This Gamliel is known as Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. Following his death, Rabban Gamliel of Yavne was succeeded by his son, who is known as Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who was in turn succeeded by his son, Rabbi Yudah HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, author of the Mishnah. Rabbi Judah the Prince is then succeeded as Nasi by his son, whose name is, wait for it, Gamliel. Okay. So there will be a test on all these names immediately following the lecture. With this in mind, let us now turn to the text of Avot and see how this dynasty is described. Following Hillel and Shammai, we are introduced to Hillel's successor in your version in Mishnah 16. Rabban Gamliel Omer, Aseh Lecha Rav, V'Yistalek Min HaSafek. This is Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, Rabban Gamliel the Elder, the Nasi at the end of the Second Temple period. He is, as we mentioned yesterday, the first rabbi to be called Rabban, which is the new title of the Nasi. And his maxim, as we have seen, cautions against anarchy. The following Mishnah, 17, introduces us to his son, Shimon bino Omer. Shimon, his son, used to say. Note that this Shimon is not called Rabban Shimon. And this commentator suggests, maybe due to the fact that he died in the fall of Jerusalem before he could fully assume the position of Nasi. But look what happens next. Immediately after this Mishnah, Mishnah 17, we are introduced in Mishnah 18 to another Shimon ben Gamliel, who is called Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, al shlosha dvarim ho'olam kayam. This, according to most opinions, is the grandson of the Shimon that we met in the previous Mishnah. He is the son of Rabban Gamliel of Yavneh, and he is the father of Rabbi Judah the prince. And indeed, the next chapter picks up, if you look at Mishnah 1, with Rabbi Omer, that's Rabbi Judah the prince. But Rabban Gamliel of Yavneh has been skipped entirely. Rabbi Judah the prince, who composed the vote, has put together a list of the dynasty from which he descends, but he has left out his own grandfather. This is interesting in itself, but when we combine this striking lacuna with another piece of information, the missing Gamliel becomes even more intriguing, and that is the following fact. In its listing of the Hillelian family, in its description of the dynasty of the Nisim, the patriarchs, Tractate Avot has left out the only patriarch who was, at least for a while, fired from his position. This firing takes place in one of the turning points of Jewish history. Jerusalem has only recently fallen at the hands of the Romans, and the temple, locus of our aspirations, center of Jewish ritual, has just been destroyed. As we know, to Hillel's family was always awarded the position of Nasi, patriarch which embodied the leadership, both political and religious, of the Jewish people. The Nasi was head of the Sanhedrin and also representative of the Jews before Caesar. If the position was important before 70 CE, it was all the more essential after, because all the other factions of the Jewish people whose identity derived solely from the temple or from the war against Rome, the Sadducees, the Zealots, the Sicarii, all soon die out and disappear. And suddenly the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, the patriarch, is effectively the leader of all Jews throughout the Holy Land. Meanwhile, Rabban Gamliel of Yavneh has another challenge. Without Jerusalem, with Jews dispersed and no locus of devotion, he has to ensure the future of Jewish law, which he sees not incorrectly as tied to the authority of the Sanhedrin and his leadership of that judicial and political body. Rabban Gamliel of Yavneh, at Yavneh, after arriving, and after the departure of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, Yavneh's founder, Rabban Gamliel therefore sought to impose his own view in all halachic debates, publicly shaming those sages that disagreed with him, causing the other sages, who were the students or the students of students of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, to chafe under what they saw as Rabban Gamliel's extreme authoritarianism. After three uncomfortable experiences in which dissenters were singled out, the other rabbis rebelled and overthrew Rabban Gamliel. He was fired. Let us pause to ponder this fact. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi devotes the second half of the first parak of Avot to listing all the Nasiim, which are his ancestors, and he attaches a maxim to each one. Yet he clearly and deliberately, as we said, leaves out his own grandfather, Rabban Gamliel of Yavneh, or to put it slightly differently, he deliberately leaves out from this chain the one patriarch who was removed from office. This cannot be a coincidence. And so to ponder why Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi would have done so, to understand what lesson we are meant to learn from the mystery of the missing Gamliel, we must understand how and why he was fired. The story is told, the third incident of squelching dissent, which led to the removal of Rabban Gamliel, is described in Tractate Brachot 27b. Let us see the story. Tanu Rabbanan, Ma'ase b'talmid echad shebalifnei Rabbi Yoshua amar lo, Tfilat arvit rishut o chova. Once a student in the academy comes before Rabbi Joshua, who is a student not of Rabban Gamliel, but of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and asks him, the evening service, is it obligatory or elective? Amar li reshut. He said, optional. Balifnei Rabban Gamliel, amar lo tfilat arvit reshut o chava. This same student, who has already had his question answered, now comes before Rabban Gamliel, the head of the academy, and says, same question. Optional or obligatory? Amar lo chava, he says obligatory. Amar lo, so the student replied to the nasi, v'halo Rabbi Yeshua amar li reshut. You should know, O head of the academy, that someone else has told me the opposite of what you have just said. There is dissent in your own shop. Amar lo, Rabbi Gamliel responded, hamtenat sheichnasu ba'alei trisin levet ha-midrash. Wait till the warriors, the shield bearers, this is a euphemism for the rabbis who engage in battle over the Torah. Wait for the warriors to enter the study hall. Kishenichnasu ba'alei trisin amar ha-shoel v'sha'al tfilat arvit reshut ochava. When the rabbis entered the academy, the question was once again asked by the same student, is the evening service optional or obligatory? Amar lo Rabban Gamliel chova. Rabban Gamliel responded, it is obligatory. Amar lehem Rabban Gamliel lachachamim. And then Rabban Gamliel, in this moment of incredible drama, turns to all the sages gathered and says, Klum yesh adam shecholek b'davar zeh? Anyone disagree with me? Amar li Rabbi Yeshua lav. Rabbi Yeshua, who did indeed disagree with him, said, not me. Nobody disagrees over here. Nothing to see. Amar lo v'alo mishmech amru li reshut. But I was told in your name that you disagree with me. So you can imagine, as it were, the aura of authoritarianism and even fear that is now felt in the Beit Midrash. To this aura of authoritarianism and fear, Rabban Gamliel also adds now, public shaming. Amar le Yoshua moda raglecha ve'yidu bach. Stand on your feet, Joshua, and let testimony be heard against you. Meaning, let it be established that you did indeed disagree with me and that you were sowing dissent against my halachic opinions in the study hall. Amar Rabbi Yeshua raglav v'yamar imalei ani chai v'hu met yechol achai lachish et hamet. Which means, were he dead and I alive, I could deny this accusation. But since I am alive and he is alive, he meaning the student who actually heard this answer from Rabbi Yeshua, I can't contradict the living. And so he essentially accepts the testimony against him. Rabban Gamliel then proceeded to begin the lecture, leaving Rabbi Yeshua standing before all. It is the Yavne equivalent of making someone stand in the corner while class continues. These are all adults, of course. Ad sharanenu kol ha'am v'amru l'chutzpita turgaman amod v'amad. Until this caused such great resentment from all the students that they said to chutzpit ha'meturgaman, whose job was to act as Rabban Gamliel's microphone, to repeat what he said, perhaps in Aramaic, so that everyone could hear the lecture. They said to him, stop conveying the lecture, which is the rabbinic version of silencing Rabban Gamliel's microphone. And so he stopped. Amre. Then they began murmuring to each other and planned a rebellion. Amre, they said, Ad kama netzare v'nezal. How long will we let Rabban Gamliel persecute us? Barosh Hashana ishtaked tzare. Last Rosh Hashanah, in a debate over the calendar, he persecuted and shamed Rabbi Yeshua. Bivchoro b'maseh Rabbi Tzadok tzare. In a question concerning the firstborn, Rabbi Tzadok was persecuted. Hachanami tzare. Now again he persecutes Rabbi Yeshua. Tav v'navre. Let us remove him. Let's throw him out of the academy. Let's fire him from his position as Nasi, head of the Sanhedrin, and leader of the academy at Yavne. But this inspired a question. If we're going to fire him, we have to replace him. Who is the right man for the job? Ma nukimle? Nukme le Rabbi Yeshua? Baal ma'asehu. We can't replace him with Rabbi Joshua. That would look bad because he is someone who is party to this incident. So that would look too suspicious. Nukme le Rabbi Akiva? Dilma anishle de lesle schutavot. Should it be Rabbi Akiva? Rabbi Akiva does not have any illustrious ancestors whose merit can protect him against any curses that might be placed upon him from Rabban Gamliel and his party. Ela nukmel Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, du chacham v'hu ashir v'hu asiri le'ezra. Let us appoint Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. He has, as we say in Yiddish, alamailas. He has all the virtues. He is wise. He is a Tamid Chacham. He's a scholar. He's rich. And he is 10th in line in descent from Ezra Sofer, the creator of the men of the great assembly. Why are these virtues important? Hu Chacham Dimak Shalei Mafrakle. He is a scholar so that he can answer any question that is asked. Hu Ashir Diitlei Lefluch LeBeKesar Afu Ezel Upalach. He's rich, which means that he has influence with the Caesar, so he can act politically on our behalf as Nasi as well. And he has illustrious ancestors that will protect him. This is one of my favorite lines in the entire Talmud. They come to him and say, "We fired Rabbi Gamliel. Time for a promotion. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, would you like to be the head of the academy?" And he said, "Ezel ve'imlich bin shibeti." Which means, I got to ask my wife, which was then paralleled when Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz, the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, was telephoned by his dear friend, Margaret Thatcher, who told him that she wished to make him the first rabbinic member of the House of Lords in the 1,000-year history of that parliamentary house. And she said to him, "I'd like to give your name into the Queen, recommend you for this extraordinary honor." And she says to him, "So can I do it? Can I make you into a lord?" And Rabbi Jacobovitz says, "I need to ask my wife." And he called up his wife, who was then in America, and he said to her, "Would you like to become a lady?" She said, "Yes." So here too, I need to ask my wife. He went to ask his wife, Amra le. So she said to him, "They fired the last one." This is, as we say in Yiddish again, a tough shteller. This is a tough position for rabbis. Who says you want this job? Better to use an expensive goblet even if it breaks the next day. Meaning, even if I lose the position, I might as well take it while I can. Amrale, and she says to him, "Let lechiyurta, you have no white hair. You're very young. How will anyone take you seriously as the head of this academy?" Hahu yoma bar tamne sare shanehu. And that day he was only 18. Itrachish le nisa, and a miracle occurred. 18 rows of hair turned white in his beard that evening. Hainu dekam Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and that is why Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, quite famously in the Haggadah, "Hare ani kiven shivim shana." I am like 70 years old. He did not say, "I am 70 years old." He was only 18, but he looked like he was 70 years old. Now this, by the way, just as an aside, but an important aside, allows us to understand one of the most famous passages in the Haggadah, the one that precedes Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's statement. And that is the description of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and Rabbi Tarfon, the sages gathering together for a Seder in Bnei Brak. What is striking about that passage is that the Haggadah presents us with a gathering of rabbinic leadership, but the Nasi, Rabban Gamliel, is missing. Or is he? Is the Nasi missing? The statement at the Seder of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, "Hare ani kiven shivim shana," allows us to mark the moment when the Seder is being celebrated. It occurs right after Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah has replaced Rabban Gamliel as the Nasi. And that allows us to understand why all the great rabbis of the generation are gathered at that Seder, but not the man who had been officially the head of the Sanhedrin, descendant of Hillel. Rabban Gamliel has not joined the other sages at that Seder because he has been fired. Rabban Gamliel, meanwhile, saw himself and got himself in this position because he saw himself as struggling to preserve the authority of the Nasi in an age where the temple was reduced to ashes. He was attempting to stave off anarchy. He was attempting to prevent a moment where every Jew would do what was right in his own eyes. But the Talmud makes clear that Rabban Gamliel had gone too far. And one of the ordinances of Rabban Gamliel of Yavne was a restriction that he placed on who was permitted to enter the academy. Under Rabban Gamliel's leadership, only the spiritual elite were allowed in. And he had gone so far as to appoint a bouncer for the Beit Midrash to prevent any but the elite from entering. This ordinance was removed by his successor, the new Nasi, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Tana, the Talmud continues, it was taught, Oto Hayom, that very day, Salku l'shomer ha-petach, they removed the security guard from the door. V'natana lehem reshut l'talmidim li-kanes. And they allowed all students who desired to enter the study hall. She'er Rabban Gamliel machriz v'omer kol tamid she'en tocho kevaro lo yikanes l'beit ha-midrash. For Rabban Gamliel had originally insisted that any student whose insides are not like his outsides, which means that there is something lacking in his conduct and his character, he is not allowed to enter the study hall. That restriction was removed. And a new period, the period of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's leadership, begins. The bouncer is taken away, and what occurs is an explosion of Torah study, the likes of which rabbinic Judaism had not yet seen. Hahu Yoma, we are told, that day, itosu kama safsale, many, many benches, many chairs were added to the study hall. How many is debated? Either 400 or 700. But Torah study explodes. At that moment, chalsha da'atei de Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel felt disheartened. Seeing this, he said, Dilma chas v'shalom manati Torah mi Yisrael. Maybe in my restrictions I have prevented Torah study from increasing in Israel. Achzule b'chalmei chatzvei chiorei demalyin kitma. They showed him in his dream, meaning God allowed him to see in a dream, white jugs filled with ashes, which was a symbol, as it were, of these students whose insides were not parallel to their outsides. Rabban Gamliel took that as a sign that he had actually been correct in only allowing the elite into the Beit Midrash. And then the Talmud adds remarkably, Velohi, but he was not right. He was wrong. And Ahili tuve daite hu daxule. Rabban Gamliel was only shown this dream to make him feel better. But he actually was wrong. He had, it would seem, violated one of the first maxims in Avot. He'emidu talmidim harbe. In today's day and age, Torah study should be increased, we are told, by the men of the Great Assembly, by increasing as many students as possible. Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne felt, apparently, that that was the proper approach with the end of prophecy, but with the temple still in existence. But now, with Jerusalem in ruins and a remnant surviving at Yavne, a new approach was required, and elitism was demanded, and only the truly worthy would be allowed. That was his attitude. But, says the Talmud, he was wrong. And this is an amazing Talmudic statement. Very rarely does a condemnation of this sort appear regarding one of the pillars of Torah Judaism. Rabbi Gamliel's strictures, the Talmud says, were incorrect, misguided. And his mistake in this regard is linked to his colleagues' critique of him when they engaged in their revolution. Rabban Gamliel, the sages believed, failed at what they saw as his primary challenge, his primary obligation at this terrible time, which was to allow for the flourishing of Torah views and interpretations to bloom at Yavne while still preserving unity. Rabban Gamliel and contrast believed that at this moment, with the temple destroyed and Judaism profoundly weakened, both possibilities, the flourishing of open debate and halachic consistency and unity, both possibilities were irreconcilable. You can have one or the other. And he could not risk Jewish unity. He could not risk the nasiat of his family. It had to be preserved, not for himself and for his honor, but as he saw it, for the future of Klal Yisrael. And so he squelched debate. He shamed Rabbi Yeshua, and he limited the number of those allowed in the study hall. But he was wrong. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the new Nasi, knew that he was wrong. The security guard was removed, and what results is a golden moment of learning. And the form that this golden period takes is important. Tana, it was taught, Eduyot bo bayom nishnet. The halachic rulings that ultimately made up the tractate in the Mishnah known as Eduyot, those rulings were taught on that day in the academy, under the leadership of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And we are also further informed that even Rabban Gamliel did not avoid the study hall at that moment. So drawn was he to all the learning that was taking place. Now we have to understand the profound irony here. Adiot refers to the tractate where a variety of legal conundrums were resolved and consensus around complex questions was achieved. Rabban Gamliel had strictly guarded against being challenged. He limited participation in the Beit Midrash, in halachic discussion, in order to prevent anarchy, in order to preserve unity. And in the end, it is the diversity of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's Beit Midrash that both allows for ideas to be debated and discussed, but also for consensus to be achieved. Rabban Gamliel's reaction to the historic crisis facing the Jewish people was understandable. But in the end, the exact opposite response was required. And ultimately, Rabban Gamliel himself comes to understand this. The Talmud describes the further edification of Rabban Gamliel, how he came to conclude that he had been overly zealous and mistaken. And then we are informed that Rabban Gamliel said to himself, "Seeing as how Rabbi Yeshua is clearly correct, I must go and appease him." Ha'il v'achihu ezel v'ayfai seyler Rabbi Yeshua. And so he goes to seek his forgiveness. Kimata lebeite, when he reaches Rabbi Joshua's house, chazinu la'ashita debeite de'mishachran. He saw that the walls of Rabbi Yeshua's house were black. Amar le, so he said to Rabbi Yeshua, mikotle beiteich ata nikar shepach miata. It turns out that you are a blacksmith. I deduce that from seeing the walls of your house, which means that Rabbi Yeshua had a trade, as many of the rabbis did, as we mentioned in our discussions before. But Rabban Gamliel had no idea what Rabbi Yeshua did for a living. He was the Nasi, but as leader, he had no actual contact with the daily lives of the ones who were supposed to be his disciples. And he had clearly never been to Rabbi Joshua's house before. And only upon arriving there, he realizes, hey, you work for a living, and you're a blacksmith. The reaction of Rabbi Joshua is fierce. Amarlo, Rabbi Joshua says to Rabban Gamliel, "Oy lo ledor sha'ata parnaso, woe to the generation that has you as its leader. Shi'iyata yodea b'tzaran shel talmidei chachamim. You do not even know the pain that the sages experience, how hard it is for most of them to eke out a living. Bamehem mitparnasim, how they support themselves. Ubamehem nizonim, and how hard they work to put food on their table." It's at this moment that Rabban Gamliel realizes how wrong he has been, not only in his attitude toward halachic debate, but in his lack of a common touch, in his lack of an ability to actually identify with the members of the academy that are actually supposed to be his sacred charge. Amarlo, so Rabban Gamliel says to Rabbi Yeshua, "Naneti lach, I have caused you great pain. Mecholi, please forgive me." "Forgive me," he says. "Lo ashkach be." Rabbi Joshua ignores him and did not respond. And then Rabban Gamliel tries another tack. "Asei bishvil kivod abba," he says. "Please forgive me out of respect for my father." And then P.S. He agreed and he forgave him. We have to understand this passage. If Avot leaves the Rabban off of Rabban Gamliel's father, if Rabban Gamliel's father appears as Shimon Beno, Shimon the son of the original Rabban Gamliel, as a sign of his tragic death, if Rabban Gamliel's father died in the destruction of Jerusalem, then Rabban Gamliel's plea to Rabbi Yeshua for forgiveness in his father's merit is redolent with emotion. "Forgive me in merit of my father," not only invokes the memory of a martyr, it also to some extent provides exculpatory information for Rabban Gamliel's actions. "My father," he is saying, "my father was murdered. He died in the destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem, in the greatest tragedy to yet hit the Jewish people. See my actions, however misguided, in that light. See what I have done in reaction to this terrible tragedy." And Rabbi Yeshua agrees, and he finally forgives him. He forgives him. And ultimately, the Talmud tells us, Rabban Gamliel was restored to his position as Nasi, but the job was forever shared with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. That is the story of Rabban Gamliel's removal and ultimately of his partial restoration. We return then, now knowing the story, to the dynasty listed in Avot and to the man who is missing. And we can now understand how loudly we hear the sound of silence that is the missing Mishnah of Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. We meet first Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, who tells us to avoid doubt through the mastery of the Nasiyet. Aseh l'charav v'istalek min ha-safek. We are then introduced to Shimon Beno, the man who dies in the destruction of Jerusalem. And all of a sudden, any reader of Avot who knows his history realizes that Rabban Gamliel of Yavne, the fired Gamliel, is missing. The reader of Avot is meant to be struck by that fact, an absence that is glossed over by every reader of Avot today is meant to hit us in the face. We are meant to say to ourselves, hey, where's Rabban Gamliel? And then all of a sudden, we are introduced, after the skipping of Rabban Gamliel, to the son and successor of Rabban Gamliel of Yavne, to Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, and to his maxim. Let us study it carefully. The final Mishnah in the first chapter. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Al Shlosha Devarim Ha'olam Kayam. On three things does the world, what is the translation of Kayam? Al Shlosha Devarim Ha'olam Kayam, which means literally, through three things the world endures. Al Hadin, V'al Ha'emet, V'al Ha'shalom. And din means judgment, v'al ho'emet, and truth, and shalom, which is peace. Shenemar, as it says, emet u'mishpat shalom, shiftu b'sharichem. Here, strikingly, the final maxim in the first chapter echoes the first maxim that is given to us by an individual sage at the beginning of this first chapter. But there are differences. They have the same name, which actually establishes a literary link. They each speak of three things. We are meant to notice the similarity, but the similarity is what also makes the differences stand out. Shimon HaTzadik spoke of three things on which the world stands, which means he is referring to three actions for which the world was created, the three activities that God most dearly desires. But here, we are presented with a slightly different statement. Not on three things the world stands, but on three things the world endures, or through three things the world endures. And they are din, which means judgment or law, emet, truth, and shalom is peace. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel is giving us three virtues that are often in tension with one another. Din, this is halakha, Jewish law, which is meant to be the source of unity for our people. Then there is emet, truth, which is the search for the true will of God. And then there is shalom, peace. The absence of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel's father and the reason for it allows us to better understand what Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel is telling us and why he, the only man who experienced in his family an actual firing of his father, might have made this his maxim that he left as his legacy. In his search for din, for Jewish law, for unity and authority, Rabban Gamliel of Yavne squelched debate. But free exchange is necessary for the achievement of emet, for truth. And in squelching debate, what erupted was open rebellion or a violation of shalom. Rabban Gamliel's failure to understand this is emphasized by his absence. It is addressed to us by the lack of his presence. Now, his son, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, understands. For the world to be kayam, for the post-destruction world of Torah to endure, one must manage the uneasy balance between all three. Leadership lies in maintaining all of these as well as one can. Din, emet, and shalom. Maintaining all three is extremely difficult. It requires nothing less than political and halachic genius. But it is nevertheless what is required, or the world itself will not endure. This means that the conclusion of the first chapter is absolutely remarkable. It both reflects a silent, implicit acknowledgement of the firing of Rabban Gamliel, and it also teaches us that Rabban Gamliel's son understood the lessons of his father's life. But the entire structure of the chapter and the way that it concludes is even more remarkable, considering the man who put this tractate together, Rabbi Yudah HaNasi, the grandson of Rabban Gamliel of Yavneh, son of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Judah the Prince gives us a tractate that is titled Avot and begins by delineating the dynasty of his family, implying that primarily the title Avot, fathers, refers not to all the rabbis listed therein, but quite literally to his own family. He is giving us his family tree. He is telling us that primarily the fathers at the heart of rabbinic Judaism were his physical fathers, his ancestors. And he would not be wrong to leave out then his own grandfather from the recitation of his lineage is shocking. And it can only be understood, I think, in light of the tale of the rebellion against Gamliel and its accompanying lessons. And if Rabbi Yudah deliberately excludes his grandfather, it is to communicate the fact that he too, like his father, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, he, Rabbi Judah the Prince, has learned from the tale of Rabban Gamliel of Yavneh. Consider the following fascinating fact. Two generations after Rabban Gamliel's removal, Rabbi Yudah HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, accomplishes the unthinkable. He commits the oral law to writing, and he creates the first normative law for Jews since the Torah, since the Pentateuch. It is acknowledged as such by all of rabbinic Judaism, and the unity of the Jewish people is thus assured for the many centuries that follow. All this taking place only two generations after the tense rebellion and the divisions in Rabban Gamliel's Yavneh, in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yudah HaNasi's grandfather. How does he do this? How does the Mishnah come to be? What is the secret of its success? The answer lies in lessons of Rabbi Yehuda's family history and in the unique genre of law that is the Mishnah itself. The most striking aspect of the Mishnah is not that it is a universally embraced code. Rather, what is most interesting is that even as the Mishnayot present the halakha, they always include dissents. The Mishnah will tell us the law, and then it will inform us that there was a minority opinion that disagreed. Rabbi Yehoshua Omer, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, this rabbi disagreed and said this. That's not the law, but nevertheless, we are recording for posterity that there was another view. One would think that if one were seeking to create a normative code that would endure, that would unite us all, we should leave out the dissents. We should ignore them. We should allow them to be forgotten by history. That is not Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's approach. Even those who have been ruled out from becoming law, such as all the opinions of the House of Shammai, they are all included. They are all recorded. The Mishnah is both a normative code, but it is also a retaining for posterity of all the different opinions that did not become din, that did not become law, but nevertheless are retained as part of the continuing discussion of ideas, as part of the rabbinic search for emet, for truth, for the will of God. The Mishnah, even as it presents halakha, celebrates other opinions. It includes dissents, even as it asserts the law. Rabbi Yudah HaNasi thus preserves his grandfather's concern for unity, but does not exclude the other voices. Unlike his grandfather, he embraces them, he cherishes them, and he allows future generations to study them, if not to follow and obey them. Rabbi Yudah HaNasi manages, in other words, to balance beautifully and almost perfectly din, emet, and shalom in producing one of the most enduring works of Jewish law. And in composing Avot, Rabbi Judah tells us how he did this, by reciting the history of his dynasty and by omitting his grandfather and acknowledging the very fact of his at least temporary removal and reminding us forever that he and his father have learned the lesson of that tale. The mystery of the missing Gamliel is one of the most interesting aspects of Avot, because rightly understood, it allows us to see the entire structure of the first chapter in a new light, and it informs us that the man who is missing from Avot may have been one of the most influential leaders in Jewish history, because through his life story, he communicated a lesson that taught his grandson, the author of the Mishnah, perhaps more than anyone else.